Welcome to the History Sibyl. I'm Max Dashu, and in this episode, I'll be sharing with you excerpts from Volume 11 in my series, Secret History of the Witches. The title of this book is The Sorcery Charge, and it looks at roughly at the 1300s. The chapter I'm going to be talking about is called Women, Power, and Danger. If you want to support this independent scholarship and speed up production of these books, you can contribute to patreon.com/maxdashu, and I'll have a link to this sponsorship page and also other resources that are going to be on the History Sibyl podcast page. You can find them there. You can find them on the Suppressed Histories Archives website. So this chapter is actually the last in the volume titled The Sorcery Charge. And I'm looking basically at the sexual politics of witchcraft in Western European society, primarily in this chapter, in this volume. And there are sections I'm going to skip for now. I might come back to them later. But I want to look at the sexual politics of witchcraft accusations and the vulnerability of women to them, but also the power that's attributed to women, and that women themselves saw in resort to spiritual means where all other forms of society were designed to subjugate them. Everything from marriage law, inheritance, sexual behavior codes, income levels, you know, paid work or unpaid work in the case of most females. And so there's a lot of dynamics going on here. Church and state used the sorcery accusation to subjugate women. And they hurled it at every female sphere of power, including the home. If a woman manages to prevail against the disadvantages and injuries that she faced in marriage, if she exercised power in life, she must be a witch or have turned to one for assistance. The witches who were women's resort in battery or desertion, who provided contraceptive methods or love charms or medicines for colicky babies, these women were tortured and burned. From the late 1300s and increasingly through the next century, accusations of witchcraft became all the ammunition that was needed to destroy a woman. Lords, magistrates, lawyers, doctors, bishops, and inquisitors all had their differences and their own power struggles. But all of them felt threatened by insubordinate women. And they found it convenient to blame the evils of their misrule on females. Christine de Pizan, the first known professional woman writer in Europe, demanded to know, why are men so unanimous in attributing wickedness to women? At the end of the 1300s, Christine de Pizan became the leading defender of women's honor and rights and achievements. She was the daughter of an Italian astrologer at the French court. And because of that, she had access to the royal library and to private tutors. When she turned 17, her father and her husband both lost their positions. And so all of a sudden, she became poor and she began to write for a living. And as a widow, she supported three children with her pen. So she wrote various things, responding, for example, to the misogyny of Jean de Meung in Le Roman de la Rose. This was a bestseller in the courts. And she wrote a book called Le Dit de la Rose. So the Rose Speaks, and that was in 1402. And another book of hers was called The City of Women. And here she challenged the idea, this is all medieval misogyny, that women are inconstant, fickle, deceitful, greedy, and more prone to sin than males. And she dryly adds, men are not perfect. Pizan refuted the notion that women's morals would be ruined if they were educated, She challenged men's belief that their wives' advice was foolish and the familiar claim that women want to be raped. And these masculist beliefs were doctrinal in her world. She writes, "I could hardly find a book on morals where, even before I had read it in its entirety, I did not find several chapters or certain sections attacking women, no matter who the author was." Now, if we go over to Chaucer in England, the wife of Bath agreed. And she says, "It is impossible that any clerk would speak good of wives." Clerk meaning not like we think today, clerical work, but this referred to priests, the clergy, same root. But it wasn't only theologians and courtly poets who blamed women and declared them inferior and subjected them to male rule. City magistrates permitted men to inflict terrible beatings on their wives before they reached any legal limit. And, you know, there's this famous discourse about the rule of thumb, and that was, that's something that has been sort of exaggerated in the discussion of male authority to beat wives and daughters, women in the family. So I'm going to pass over that for now, and that's something that comes up later on. Actually, I haven't been able to find a specific example of that this early. But the actual privilege, the male privilege, of battering wives was very much inscribed in medieval law. And we can go all the way back to the 1200s in the French coutume, customs, right? But this is a law code, which the authors of this book allowed a husband to beat his wife as long as he did not kill or mutilate her. A law in Bergerac in the south of France encouraged the husband to draw blood as long as he did so with goodly zeal. And there's a whole backlog behind this of churchly assumptions and presumptions, prescriptions, that this was right, that the husband should discipline his wife. You know, she was under his obedience. And there's a patriarchal model there backed up by a feudal model. And this whole idea of social hierarchy based on dominance. English law as well allowed husbands to beat their wives into unconsciousness, and even murder went unpunished in practical terms. You know, prosecution rarely happened. I don't know that there's any record of any of it happening at that time. But even murder went unpunished. Bordeaux law allowed husbands to kill their wives in a rage, but the condition was they had to swear that they repented of it. Well, that's easy enough. So these passes were given for serious violence. And that is nowhere more clear than in a law called Le Privilège de Barrage, and this is in 1404, which gave men absolute authority over wives and children. And here it says, "Any household master may beat his wife and his family, and none shall be able to oppose him." So this is also, you know, I mean, there's all these layers to this, but in practice, some communities did impose at least some controls on battering, marital battering of women by men, through elders intervening, through protests of various kinds, sometimes sort of ceremonialized protests. But, you know, this law is basically even eliminating that. None shall be able to oppose him. It's his absolute right. So you have the absolute right of the husband at the most fundamental social level, and then all the way up the hierarchy, lords over peasants, kings over the whole population. This sort of divine right to dominate is written into law and gradually is absorbed into custom. And I think to some extent, if you look at European history, it had been customary. Male dominance had been customary for quite a long time. And, you know, we can look back to written records in Greece and Rome to find plenty of evidence for that. But in other ethnic cultures in Europe as well. So here we're dealing mostly with the written record to go back that far. So in Beauvais, and this would be in northern France, the lawmakers, all men of course, declared battery insufficient cause for women to leave their husbands. And here's a quote from one of my sources. They ruled that a wife ought to suffer much before deciding to leave the house of her husband. Technically, these laws allowed a woman to leave if her husband was constantly beating her, or if he threatened her life, or if he tried to sell off her property. She was supposed to have recourse to justice in order to request that he would pay subsistence to her out of their common property. But in practice, this income was tied to the batterer's cooperation. And they put little escape clauses in here, so the husband could lawfully avoid paying anything to her simply by offering to take her back with a promise, quote, to give her no further grounds for leaving. If she refused, even in fear for her life, she forfeited her share of the common property. And if she acquiesced, she could lose her life, or she could be mutilated or permanently disabled. She was his chattel. And this is something we can see generally in medieval European laws, men as absolute masters. So, you know, there were controls to some degree on this in medieval peasant communities. They were not gender egalitarian, but they did mistrust the lords. And so you have sometimes cases of these controls on violence. And the examples I'm going to give here, some of these are from a later period, but I think that we can definitely see a continuity going on here. So rural communities, British villages, for example, they would force wife beaters sometimes to ride the steng or the stang. And that meant being paraded through the village on a stick or sometimes facing backwards on a donkey, while a crowd of people ridiculed the offender. And so we have an equivalent to that also in France, which is the charivari, or sometimes called the conduct of misrule. These are sometimes festival occasions where people have like basically a public drama. And so they would publicly shame wife beaters on some occasions, but they also enforced the opposite. So they would single out cuckolds and men who the men thought in particular were dominated by their wives. And so these performances had the effect of goading men to violence to prove that they were lord and master. Another example of this in Wales, the Coultrin Court, is a good way to see how often these customs devolve into reaffirming the husband's privilege of battery. And so it's a mock court, this Coultrin Court, and it would convene when the wife had drawn her husband's blood, but never when he had shed hers, which was, of course, the great majority of cases. And so this is all run by men who act as prosecutor and defense. This is all theater, and men portrayed both a wife and husband for laughs. So you have a man dressed as a woman acting out the shrew for men to ridicule. And they would go through town in procession with pots, pans, and trumpets. So a kind of a burlesque satirization. But it had real outcomes, so that a woman who refused to abide by the judgment of this male enactment of authority in the village faced the ducking stool. And so men agree that it was proper for husbands to be masters just as long as he did not go too far. And so another built-in semi-control is that a woman's brothers or male relatives could retaliate against a batterer by beating him up on their own. But the problem here is that this depended on a consensus among the men. And what begins to happen, and I think would have begun already in the Middle Ages, if not sooner, is that all too often brothers would uphold the husband's privilege of keeping his wife, their sister, in line. So now back I come now to sorcery. The women's weapons were speech and sorcery, witchcraft. And there were female elders could publicly mock men who were guilty of battery or rape. They would incite male relations or the village itself to intervene on the behalf of a woman. And that's not to say women elders always did side with the woman. I don't think we're looking at a period where we have any more female solidarity. But there were times when women could enact some action to be taken. But the threat of witchcraft was really the most effective deterrent to male violence. And especially above all those kinds of female sorcery, the threat of magically worked male impotence. And this is something that we see canon lawyers already obsessing about in the High Middle Ages. And quite a bit of this makes its way into canon law, and it remains. It's still being talked about in the 1700s, 1800s. And so European society becoming ever more male dominated, and you see yet and still this growing male anxiety about witchcraft. It seems that popular wisdom held that all male authority and privilege could be canceled out by the power of a witch. She could stop a man from beating his wife or sleeping around. She could negate his sexual potency, or draw him to a woman who wanted to marry him, or make him return to a wife he had deserted. And we have a poem from Tuscany in the 1400s, Italian poem, listing the spells that women use to bend men to their will. And so they talk about collecting herbs by moonlight while saying words over them, chanting verses while drawing water at sunrise. And this kind of witchcraft was also found in the fairy faith. And so one Scottish story says the fairies helped a wife whose drunkard husband caused so much misery to her. And so in the story, the fairies give the wife a small stick saying, "As long as you keep this, you good man will drink nae mair." And so, you know, this is an old story, women in patriarchy trying to get the husbands not to batter them while they're soused with alcohol. In Spain, you have fountains with erotic powers, waters that could be drunk from that would perhaps attract a lover. And so common women have this reputation for defying the sexual double standard, which is, of course, another form of the authority of husbands. And so you see aristocratic men taunting peasant men as cuckolds, incapable of mastering their wives. This is a term, by the way, that's been resurrected by the modern U.S. Right-wing movement, cucks. There's this whole discourse about cucks, and these are men who are controlled or dominated by women, and they're obsessed with this. So these are old tropes. So, you know, the stereotype of the fishwife, you know, just a woman with a loud voice, a woman who is indomitable. The common scold who is sharp-tongued in defending her rights, you know, nags and scolds. And of course, the scold's bridle is intended as a public humiliation and a literal silencing mechanism. Put this head cage over the woman's head and lock down her tongue with a special metal plaque, sometimes with spikes in it, to physically prevent her from speaking and resisting. And so caricatures of female rage are scattered through medieval sermons, showing us that women were not resigned to their hard lot. You know, the very heavy workload they had, the physical battering that they underwent, the risks of sexual violence, the infant mortality, all of these things that they suffered, and the beatings from their husbands. And it seems that large numbers of women would leave. They would get out. It's like, I'm out of here, abusive situation. And so we see this common law pattern of serial alliances and de facto divorces. The church, of course, allowed no divorce. And so, you know, one strategy is just not to get married in the first place. There were all kinds of battles over this. And, you know, a lot of people don't even realize that marriage, you know, became a sacrament quite late. So it was possible to get away to some degree with some sexual independence, but the church was very much obsessed with, you know, flogging women around the church and other kinds of humiliating punishments for fornication. And there the sexual double standard is very much in play, and the targeting of women, you know, for things that would be tolerated in men. And there's this factor, though, that women fought back. They're facing uneven physical odds, but laboring women were muscular enough to inflict damage on assailants. And they're walking around with knives worn on their belts, and they knew how to use kitchen hatchets and frying pans. But those hatchets are the weapons of choice by women fighting in medieval court records. And you see a lot of church sculptures in England and elsewhere that show female resistance in a context that really savors of the witch ride. Women fighting or jousting with their husbands, broom versus hoe, or sometimes the distaff versus the sword, and riding, or lance, riding on barn animals. And like many comments about the war of the sexes, these carvings mock and trivialize wife beating. This was not an equal match, these quote-unquote fights, physically or legally. Certainly not in terms of the priestly authority. And so, you know, one of the ways that women fought back was with words. And another way was with actual physical resistance. And there were a lot of different strategies, but women especially fought back by passing on to their daughters remedies that had been transmitted orally for over generations. Some of these had to do with ceremonies they would perform at marriage in order to ensure that their husband would not dominate them. A lot of stuff about this in Welsh folklore, various rituals in Germany and Russia and other places that were really about the struggle over to overcome male dominance. And so to assert their rights and for recourse against wrongs done to them, many women turn to a familiar figure, the witch. So here's Chaucer again. Hylome there was dwelling in my country, an archdeacon, a man of high degree, that boldly did execution of punishing of fornication, of witchcraft, and eke of bawdry, of defamation and advoutry. That's around 1400. And we see in this period, in the late 1300s, there's a rash of sexual politics trials. In Italy and France and Switzerland, women were accused in court of using sorcery to control their relations with men, to control the men. And this charge had always entered into baronial and episcopal persecutions. But in this time period, the late 1300s, the clergy's fulminations against witchcraft had escalated. And you see a growing number of cases presided over by the same magistrates that had written these patriarchal family laws that I was telling you about. But even these oppressive laws did not go far enough for them, because 14th century women refused to submit as intended. They resisted. And so these attempts to outlaw female power and rights and professions and sexuality somehow failed. Witches were foremost among those empowering women to resist. And so the witch acts as a counselor to poor women. And she's encouraging them to believe they could do something to get what they wanted in the world, and that they had the power somehow to keep others from victimizing them. So among the earliest recorded Italian witch trials was a proceeding against Gabrina degli Alberti. And she was a witch by public fame, and had been accused by people that the court deemed, quote, worthy of faith. So in July 1375, she was brought before a secular tribunal presided over by the mayor of Reggio Emilia. And the court states that her career as a witch went back to 1367. The Inquisitio states she taught many persons and instructed them to bewitch with herbs, incantations, prohibited and dishonest acts and gestures. Well, this is, you know, everything we have is recorded from the anti side here. You know, it's all very much a male dominant perspective. But the specialty is we can extract it from these court records. Of Gabrina was helping women in their problems with men. And so women who had been battered or betrayed or abandoned by their husbands came to her. Husbands moving with their girlfriends was one of the most common problems. So, you know, they couldn't divorce, so they would just say, okay, screw you, goodbye, I'm going to go move in with a younger woman. And so this is what had happened to Franceschina Avanzi, whose case prompted the first charge raised against Gabrina. And Franceschina was in desperation because of the constant violence that she was subjected to by her husband. And so the spell, as we see it described here in this court record, and this is certainly not the full story, but they say, well, she instructed her to put her own leg hairs and her husband's fingernails into the heart of a black hen, place it in her vulva, and take 9 steps carrying a lighted blessed candle, that magical 9 there, and then reduce the heart to powder and mix it into a dish served to the unfaithful husband. This is a theme of women's sorcery that is really widespread. Mixing things into the food, because they're the food preparers, right? And you'll see women of African descent doing this under slavery in the diaspora, and lots of different European versions of this, not just in Italy, what we're seeing here. The second charge against Gabrina was that she had helped Giacobina, the wife of Pietro di Parma, and she wanted to make him stop beating and verbally abusing her, and to leave his girlfriend. So again, unfaithful husband beating his wife. You know, it's just like 2 wrongs packed up into one. So the witch advised her, in this case, to feed him chamomile powder to calm him and make him easier to handle. Well, you can see this is a real hard uphill road. I don't know that chamomile is that powerful. But anyway, I think that there's the dimension of the rituals that she's employing and the charms and so forth that are an important part to this. But it's also the idea of giving her something to use as a remedy. And so this chamomile prescription she also gave to Catina Mazzoli, Agnesina di Stregis, and the wife of Prosperino. So these are from the court records. But the black hen heart remedy failed for Elisabetta Potaccini. And so Gabrina told her to throw salt into a fire while chanting, "So might Botazzo be hot for me as his mother was for him." And she was to put her hand on her vulva, then on her mouth, and her husband would kiss her there passionately. Another woman who was deserted by her husband was recommended a different ritual, to adore a star and salute it, and then twist her shirt, saying that as the shirt was twisted, so would the heart of her husband be instead of her own. And these star adoring ceremonies I found also referred to in Spanish records. So this is a wider form of women's magic. Okay, so the Strega Gabrina also dealt with women who wanted the love of certain men or whose love was not being returned. And court papers indicated some of these women did end up marrying their man. She also treated a man who was terrified of women, and he would become overcome with fear whenever he tried to approach them. So she told him he would be freed if he got a sword that had killed a man, placed it in a bed, and slept there with a woman. Okay. None of this testimony shows Gabriele degli Alberti harming anybody. But the court ruled that she was a sorceress and enchantress who had violated the laws of church and state. Now, we don't know that she was ever burned at the stake, but the only court record that we have says that they condemned her to be branded with the mark of infamy and to have her tongue cut out. And then there's no more record of her fate. We do know, though, that a lot of times these persecutions were serial and cumulative, so that a woman who was convicted earlier on would later on be burned, or that the accusations would continue coming. And so there are many, many examples of that in the course of these witch hunt records. There's another example from Italy in Scarperia and the Mugello. The only woman in this period to be executed for practicing sorcery was Giovanna di Francesco. And so again, witchcraft to make a man love a woman. And she also performed a spell to make the man who fathered her three quote-unquote illegitimate children return to her from Hungary. And this looks like, you know, these are all cases of her doing witchcraft inside of her own marriage, not as a practitioner or, you know, a counseling witch. They also say that she did divinations on the eve of her marriage to a weaver from Venice. And this is using Christian prayers. It's not all pagan. A lot of substitution of, I mean, otherwise you're just certainly in more danger using things that are, you know, at least Christian, they can be seen as prayers and not as spells. And so anyway, she was beheaded, not burned at the stake. There's a lot of variation still in this period about what kinds of punishments are used. In 1370, there's a woman in Florence named Marta who was arrested and tortured as a witch. And she was said to have been seen making magical signs as she stood naked over a dish with burning candles. What's interesting about this is that we have a contemporary Flemish painting that actually shows a naked woman making passes in a similar rite to attract a lover. And there is a man poking his head through the door so that the artist is showing that her ritual is succeeding, because look, here he is, he showed up. Then we have, this is somewhat rare because these are noble women, aristocrats in Switzerland, and we see several of them being tried in Basel in 1407 for using witchcraft to win back the attentions of their husbands. And so these women ended up being banished. Some of the better known cases do involve aristocratic women. And, you know, so then there was more likelihood of this all being written down because it wasn't well known at the time. So in 1370, the English Parliament tried Alice Perrers for witchcraft. And the claim was that she had used love spells to gain control over the king. There's a lot of examples like this. Now, this woman, Alice Perrers, was the mistress of Edward III. And his indifference to politics was equal only to her involvement in the royal affairs. So really, this accusation of love sorcery was a pretext for aristocratic men to undermine the political power she exercised as the mistress of the king. But common women did have a lot of demand for the services of witches. And some of the names for witches indicate that they were often old women. And so we've got French vieille femme, Welsh gurach, really means a hag, a magical hag. In Polish, kobieta stara, old woman as a witch. Even sage femme in French, which is often used for midwives. There is this overlap between women who were healers or midwives and witchcraft. So going back to Italy, Matteuccia Franceschi in Castello di Ripa Bianca is doctoring babies suffering from worms, but she had another specialty. And this is a quote. Countless times she brought husbands back to their wives and faithless lovers back to their girlfriends. And so, you know, we can see that women obviously are her constituents. And so this old woman was burned at the stake in 1428 as, quote, a woman of evil condition, life, and reputation, public enchantress, sorceress, and witch. Now, I may come back. I have some other stories here from French witch trials, and I may save those for another episode. Let's see. I don't want this to be long. There's several pages here. I think I'll do these in a separate episode. But I'll just put this one little piece in here from the torture of a woman named Massette, who was married to Jean de Rouy. And so she's tortured until she says, well, I got this man to marry me by using a special ointment. And they moved to another village and ran a tavern inn. So the court transcript says, during that time between her and her said husband, there were numerous quarrels and arguments. As much because her said husband abused and beat her because she didn't want to do and carry out his wishes, as because she answered him very harshly and sharply, telling him that she was as good as her said husband was. And so the stiff language is typical in these transcripts. For which thing he led her a very bad and hard life, beating her as often as not. And so she, seeing that in no way could she stay with her said husband, because of the beatings he gave her, remembering and considering part of the things told to her by her aforesaid, and this is female, neighbors, of Rilly and Anjou, that she had found to be true, and wanting to try and know if the other things here written above told by them to her might also equally be true, on a certain day she does not recall, she being alone in her room in the inn, in the said place of Guérard, her aforesaid husband absent and about his business, she called three times, one after the other, prayed and requested that the aforesaid Luciafer to help her to put her husband in such a state that never in this world could he beat or abuse her who spoke. And so, you know, this confession sounds a lot like other witch testimony extracted under torture or the threat of torture, the calling on the devil, wax image molded and poked with a knife. But there's a more realistic ring when Massette is talking about her miserable marriage to a tavern keeper and all this battering with alcoholic overtones. And her reference to the fact that women neighbors advised and taught her sorcery for marriage situations is especially intriguing. So I just wanted to throw that in there because you can get a really good taste for how all of this is something that is in the court transcripts. You know, there's a lot of clear-cut information in here about the way that witch trials function to enforce male dominance, to impose also interpretations on the story, you know, to re-spin it according to the prejudices of the clergy and the magistrates, whoever is in charge of these trials. Anyhow, I'll come back in another webcast and I'll talk to you about two other important cases, just completely imbued with sexual politics in Paris. But just not to keep this too long of a webcast, I'm going to move forward in the chapter here and talk about what happened at the end of the 1300s and the way that the sorcery charge was really given, you know, just like oil poured on the fire, and just this real fanning of the flames of sorcery mania by the learned doctors of the Sorbonne, So the university professors are in here really dabbling a lot in demonology, as well as their always existing doctrines of male supremacy that are, you know, part of canon law, part of both church and state. And so these scholastic demonologists, these professors of the Sorbonne, are being called on as expert witnesses, consultants on theology and law. And so they were very happy, eager to seize this opportunity to inject their woman-hating commentary into certain witch trials going on in Paris, because there they were, right there at the Sorbonne. And so their sensationalist charges against the sorcières, the witches, were repeated in the streets, along with news of the latest executions of poor women. You know, and just the fact that a lot of people in the community are coming to watch these women being incinerated is part of the overall climate that women are finding themselves to have to somehow try to survive. They weren't getting any sympathy for whatever their husbands would be doing to them. And so in the wake of the burnings of several of these sorcières involved in sexual politics trials in the 1390s, the theological faculty at the Sorbonne delivered a really crucial blow in this war against the sage-femme, against the wise women, after these insubordinate females had been burned. So several years later, in September of 1398, these learned doctors proclaimed 28 articles defining sorcery as a pact with the devil, the enemy of God, and therefore as treason, blasphemy, and heresy, and obviously thus worthy of death. There, after years of field testing in the Inquisition, you know, first the Inquisition was really launched to fight the Cathars and then other heretics, and then gradually more and more they begin burrowing along and expanding their sphere of authority to witchcraft. And so the problem was there were doctrinal barriers I won't get into about that right now. But, you know, they came up with a new rationale for witch persecutions, calling witches heretical because they were, quote-unquote, devil worshippers, according to the clergy. So by calling them heretical, this helped to remove some of the old canonical obstacles to inquisitors taking action against witchcraft. Now, those obstacles had never been unsurmountable to the more zealous inquisitors. We are seeing from about 1370 on, sorcery charges begin to really figure prominently in inquisitorial torture trials from northern Spain and into southern France and northern Italy. But in order for mass prosecutions to proceed, an old doctrine, the canon episcopi, which described witchcraft as a heretical illusion, had to be pushed out of the way. And the new definition said, no, there's really a dangerous new sect. This is not like what the church fathers who are always right were talking about before. This is a new pressing danger threatening society. So this 1398 proclamation of the Sorbonne declared that witchcraft was a growing threat that had never been so widespread. And it actually spells out that a pagan revival was in progress. This is Henry Charles Lee, the historian of the Inquisition and the witch hunts back 100 years ago. He says, the preamble recites that action was necessary in view of the active emergence of ancient errors which threatened to infect society. The old evils, we'll put a question mark over that, which had been well nigh forgotten, were reviving with renewed vigor. The university then proceeded to declare that there was an implied contract with Satan in every superstitious observance. So all the folk magic and medicine all of a sudden now becomes devil worship. Actually, it had been called that for a while. And it condemned as erroneous the assertion that it was permissible to invoke the aid of demons or to seek their friendship or to use sorcery for good purposes or for the cure of sorcery. And so at the end of the 1300s, the momentum of witch persecutions was pumped up by an alarmist coalition of theologians, secular prosecutors, and disgruntled husbands. And both the church and state, whether that was the old aristocratic order or the rising bourgeoisie, found convenient scapegoats in women witches for the crises of a collapsing social order. We have to look back now at the larger context, and social dislocation, severe economic hardship had disrupted transmission of the old folk heritage. People in the 1300s had already been through the shocks of famine, war, plague, the smashing of peasant revolts, brigandage, the Inquisition, and under those hammers, the culture of the besieged commoners lost a lot of its original shape and its transmission. People were starting to move away from the land in growing numbers and into the towns, and there were no groves and natural grottos there. There were churches. More people were going to mass and hearing sermons denouncing sorcery. So, you know, this really was being propagated by the clergy. And those who did not attend church ran the risk of excommunication, with a further risk of being hauled in front of the Inquisition, coming under suspicion because they weren't submitting to the authority of the priesthood. So you see human realities being violently brought into line with misogynist codes, whatever the human cost, and it was high in such desperate times, that cost. It would not be paid by rulers and prelates, by the priesthood, but by the common people. The poor would lose their healers. Oppressed peasants and town dwellers would turn against their own kind, trading scandalous delusions for a reality they feared to confront, especially not to confront the lords that sat at the top of the whole heap. The old and disabled would be attacked. Above all, women, unmarried, crones, vagabonds, wives, prostitutes, wise women, lesbians, beggars, midwives, pagans, Christians, women would be burned. People began to be influenced by the dogma of the torture trials that had begun to proliferate. The definition of witch changed for the worse. And we can see in the trials of the late Middle Ages, witches were still very often understood to be healers, diviners, blessers, enchanters. Sorcery was pagan and therefore a forbidden art. So it was not considered crucial to show evidence of evil intent. The churchmen who were denouncing witches sometimes still acknowledged that these women were achieving results. They healed, their predictions came true, they caused or prevented conception. But by the Renaissance times, when the witch craze really begins to take hold in a epidemic way, most of the doctrinal and legal authorities refused to concede that their victims did any good, and they cast them exclusively as slaves of the devil, a devil who was now also increasingly male, whereas before, sometimes they were saying, well, it's Diana or it's some other goddess that these witches are associated with. So as these views took hold in the larger society, the witch hunting frenzy ran like fire through the social fabric of Europe. The positive spiritual values of the pre-Christian cultures were consumed in the blaze, and women's roles and behavior were permanently transformed. I'm going to stop there, but I'll just say that this business about the names of the witch and the demonization of the witch, I talk about that in chapter 3 of my book, Witches and Pagans, Women in European Folk Religion. I'll put the link for that into the podcast page so you can look it up. I have a page with some excerpts and some video talks about that also. But what I want to say about it is that the names are not what we are led to expect of the witch as a harm doer, harmful sorcery, but are referring to women who are seers and knowers and healers and herbalists and various types of shamanic knowledge, shape-shifting, and working energy, and being still seen by the common people as helpers and healers. So that's important to know because, you know, it from our historical vantage point, we have such a heavy overlay of demonized images of the witch, including, you know, Disney cartoons and all of the mass market Halloween culture as it's been devised in the last couple hundred years, coming out of the period of the witch hunts. So it's important to know that there was this folk culture, that there were alternative ways of seeing all this besides what the elite men of church and state, the universities, the bishops, the canon lawyers, the local village priest, who was sometimes in on this himself as well. All of those groups become the ones that define all of this. But in the process of trying to stamp all of these things out, they also managed to actually record it for us. You know, they were writing down, well, they do this and they do that. And as a result of their repression, we have a written record. It's not complete, but it's a partial record that can give us some idea about who these women were called, you know, what the cultural names for them were in the ethnic culture, and some of the practices. So that's what I've got for you this time. And I think in the next episode, I might talk to you more about Jean de Brigue, La Cordière, in the 1390, one of the witches in Paris that was brought to trial, and a pretty detailed breakdown of the sexual politics were played out by accusing husbands and witches that women were consulting because they were being deserted by their lovers or by their husbands. And we'll go into that in more depth because it's really great when you can get that level of detail. It's not always available. So thank you. And if you want to support this independent scholarship, then you can contribute through Patreon, patreon.com/maxdashu. And this and the other links to resources, look on the History Sybil podcast page, and you'll be able to click over and find those resources. All right. Thank you.